let's set this up by kind of explaining how this session came about. Richard and I and a group of people that includes John Sloss over at Synetic have worked very well together to integrate marketing and distribution and digital so that the conversation really becomes about how all of these areas, including PR as well, really can benefit from data exchange, from understanding each other in great detail. What often happens is that marketing and distribution becomes very siloed and very separate, and then when you add the digital component, that even gets even more siloed as its own form of marketing, and often it's treated as kind of a separate channel or, you know, even kind of the kids' table type of approach. And so when people ask, what's made the collaboration of this model work so well together, it's really having literally, five times a day conversations and just learning. And so I've learned a lot about the current state of distribution and PR, and used that information to improve on the way we've done marketing. So when we were asked to participate at South by Southwest, rather than do a panel, we thought, why don't we just extend the conversations that we have in front of all of you and explore these themes together? So that's why it's us.
And it's just the two of us. We wanted John Sloss to join us, but they didn't have a card for him. So we, unless I see him over there,
John,
you have a card?
Come on over. Special guest. No, it's great that John has his card that he walks around with. I'm sure you've seen him walk around just waiting for somebody to invite him up. And
thank you.
No, it really is this idea when I think with Exit Through the Gift Shop and Senna, I probably could speak for the three of us, and now The Way as well. People recognize it as successes in this new model, and when they ask about, how was this successful, why was it, they're often looking for kind of one thing, one stunt, one approach. And I think really what we've found is that it's about this integration, and that led to this idea of PDA. And John, was that something that you had felt, the PDA? Because PDA was really filmmaker focused, transparency in information and data, and that type of transparency, I believe very strongly, has led to all of us and everybody that's worked on these projects to be successful, because I don't have to ask for revenue data or which theaters are working and which ones aren't. They're automatically distributed to everyone, including the filmmakers, if they want to have that level of information. Some don't, but some are like, yeah, I'd love to know this theater is doing better than others. And I found working with others that most people hide all that. They don't want that level of transparency because there'll be too many questions.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence, I think, that the three of us have come together. I think we're sort of fellow travelers in this regard. I've sold over 400 films, and it was a fun thing to do when people were paying, $6 million for movies. It's less fun when they're paying a lot less than that. What I found is, as that sort of evolved and technology and the means of distribution evolved, I kept asking myself, why am I selling these films to distributors who have, 12 films to release that year, who weren't, connected to the film and the creation of the film, and who have this sort of sense of entitlement, and I don't necessarily mean you, Mr. Lorber, but where they take a grant of rights for the film for 15 years, and they basically, they're last in, first out. They keep you, as you say, on a need-to-know basis. And it just didn't really compute to me, because they don't have a monopoly or an oligopoly. And I think what we decided, and Exit to the Gift Shop provided a perfect opportunity, is that to sort of take that into our own hands and to empower filmmakers by working alongside of them to, in essence, get their films out into the world.
Yeah, and it is about data in many ways. I mean, I know, Richard, we've talked about data where, you know, the data that you would give me, I mean, sometimes it's impossible to even get, you know, what last night's grosses are unless you have, you know, access yourself to the Rentrak account. But, I mean, you and I would speak about theaters and what would be digital and what wouldn't. And what's exciting for me now, having the digital marketing, you know, focus, is that we have an incredible amount of access to behavioral data that the film industry has been very slow to really understand. You know, when web-based companies are launched, they already have in their DNA to make their software based on APIs that give that data to other developers to extend it, whether it's Twitter or whether it's Foursquare, or there's many of them, and certainly other digital businesses have built businesses on the data, but the film industry has been very slow to kind of understand how to use that. And one of the things that I'm very excited about is to really look at behavioral data as more consumption of films go towards digital, as more people are kind of watching movies through digital channels, to be able to be more efficient in marketing, to spend less to have a higher impact, but also to you know, to be able to understand exactly what's driving the actual revenue. You know, where are we getting people to convert to that download or to that purchase? And digitally, we have that data, but it's really a new thing to leverage it. On the other side, though, I think even now there's so much talk about VOD. You know, VOD is at least for now kind of being talked about as an important revenue source, but it seems to me like there's not a lot of transparency to the data of how many people actually are downloading or streaming or watching on Comcast or Cox a certain movie. And one of the benefits
to me is if I could possibly give you the data on that, and it's unfortunately withheld from me largely as well. You might get John to at least be publicly evasive about it right now. I don't know.
But what do you think? I mean,
I'm happy to be publicly evasive about it.
What do you think? Because that's one thing. I mean, I get the data reports on sales digitally and sales, and again, that's for me so beneficial. But it's hard to come by. We don't know what other films are doing. Yeah. VOD, correct? Unless it's gossip or somebody telling you, here's what the number is. Is that right or wrong?
I mean, I love my friends at the cable companies, but they are not content owner friendly. They're very much from a bricks and mortar background. And so the idea of cable VOD, I mean, cable VOD, just to sort of stand on a soapbox for a second, is such a shockingly underrealized medium. It's just depressing. It is easily the most user-friendly way to monetize films at home for filmmakers. Yet, you know, the adoption rate has been miserable, and it's because I think, you know, the mechanism, the menuing and everything else is just so behind the times, and I think that's equally reflected in their mentality toward transparency and toward providing data. It's just not a high priority for them. It seems like it's also not a high priority for them to sell, you know, films on demand. It's kind of mystifying to me, but since it's really only Comcast is better than virtually all the others, I think. You've probably found that yourself.
Yeah.
But if you don't have data, how do you have the intel then to know and to strategize? For example, the top 15 films that are on iTunes today, right? So whatever they are, do we know how many they sold in the last 8 days across? Like, do people have access to that data?
The short answer is yes. I'm kind of a Luddite, so I'm not the right person to ask. But people within Film Buff, our digital company, have access to that stuff pretty quickly. And iTunes actually pays very quickly, as opposed to the cable operators, who, if you buy something on demand, will then include it in your monthly bill. Well, then you take 30 to 60 days to pay your monthly bill, and then they account to you quarterly. So that can be 6 months before a buy on demand is converted into cash. iTunes is much more immediate and much more transparent. But there are other interesting data things like Netflix. I mean, Netflix doesn't routinely pay per stream now, but the amount of streaming people do is important data for filmmakers and for you to know and for us to know as people who sell to Netflix, so that we know what kind of films are really being consumed on Netflix. And there is a website that sort of tracks consumption on Netflix. Do you remember what it is? Matt Dentler knows. He turned me on to it, and the name escapes me. But
is it a public site?
It's a public website.
Does anybody in the audience know? I know a lot of you know.
If you email me or something or follow me on Twitter, I'm getting better.
Yeah.
Then I'll figure out what the website is. But it gives reasonably accurate data on consumption on Netflix. Like I said, that doesn't necessarily immediately turn into monetization, but it's relevant. And it's important to know. It's important for us to know going forward what kind of films work on what kind of in what kind of portals, because you know there are films that are brilliantly consumed on cable VOD and do nothing on iTunes, and by the same token, there are films that over-index on iTunes, and the same film won't do much of anything on cable VOD, and it's sort of incumbent upon us to know that.
Mm-hmm. Let me just jump back for 1 second. John was talking earlier about the occasional sense of entitlement on various ends of the spectrum here. Since we're talking about empowering filmmakers, one of the most effective things that filmmakers can do, and in fact I think are obligated to do, is do the research before you get involved. I don't mean the research on the deal terms. I mean the research on the marketplace. Which distributors have released films that are in some way similar to yours? What's the process been? What's the strategy been? So that when you sit down with and make a decision if you want to go with company A, B, or C, or try to find a way to do it independently, what's the information that you need to know in order to make it an intelligent decision? Does this company overspend? Does this company underspend? What are their strengths? What are the strengths of your film? Or do you have specific weaknesses that you can find a company which can address it most effectively? If you think that a producer's responsibility ends at the wrap party or after you're done with post or when you've delivered a finished print, then I think it's an irresponsible approach. You need to understand the process from the beginning all the way to the end. And the end at this point is going to be collecting revenue over years. And where is that revenue coming and what are the reporting processes and how can you make sure that you're protected and that your filmmakers are protected from a variety of different things that can go wrong? You can't just say, thanks for acquiring my film. Now what? You really need to be part of that process.
But, you know, there's a lot of talk. You hear this phrase, self-distribution, and you know this idea of self-distribution. But getting to know you, Richard, well, and knowing what you go through and the complexities of not just getting a film into a theater, but then dealing with the revenue splits and getting paid and all this stuff. You know, I look at that and say there's no such thing really as self-distribution, because it's not like Landmark or a theater is just going to take a phone call and suddenly open up a new account and you're going to sell. Self-distribution really means that you're putting together a dream team of people that you don't have to then go to you don't have to sell the film. You can bring great talent. And one thing that I think also was great with the PDA model, and again, these are the reasons why I believe very strongly that Exit and Senna, is that we brought the best people together. We had the best publicists with Nancy Willen and Donna Daniels, and we had, you know, the best people that were out there, and they were working with less siloed departments, and they were able to get on the phone calls every week and quickly go through what was needed. Sometimes those calls were difficult, but they were difficult in a good way, because you kind of were able to hash out what was needed for the next week and make changes. So when you hear the word self-distribution, how do you take? Does that mean somebody hires you, or they hire? What does self-distribution really mean?
I think there are some cases where filmmakers have been able to figure out how to do it truly on their own. But more often than not, they come to people who do what I do. There are a number of people who do this. There are some exhibitors that simply won't deal with filmmakers because I get calls sometimes. I spoke to so-and-so at this theater chain. They'd love to play the film, but they told me to call you, or they won't deal with me directly. And the reason is that exhibition is not set up to teach distribution 101 to filmmaker after filmmaker after filmmaker. Are there going to be press screenings? Are there going to be proper materials? Are there going to be trailers? Are they going to be flat or scope? When are they going to get to the theater? What do the press notes look like? Is there going to be a one sheet? When is the one sheet going to be delivered? There are all these the fundamental basic things that are part of the process of distributing a film that are not particularly complicated, but that have to be done in a proper sequence professionally. And exhibitors have had any number of unfortunate experiences where they're gun-shy now, and they're simply not constructed, by and large, to whether they're circuits or independent mom-and-pop venues. They're not constructed to do the hand-holding and nurture a film and do all the basics that need to be done in order to put it in place. So,
but it's also more than that. I mean, if you're in the theater, you might need at least some sort of print ad. Not everybody can call the New York Times and negotiate and put that in. I mean, there's all of that. You know, the one question, I don't expect an answer that's here is the number, but you can't have a conversation. I mean, I think half the conversations I have every day with a filmmaker who's looking at an alternative model is, it's a very broad question, and I understand why it's being asked, and that's, how much does it cost to put out a movie? And again, you know, how many cities, how many theaters? But what is the way to find out what is the answer? In the sense, there's fixed costs, there's a lot of things. If somebody comes to you, and rather than just say, you know, it depends based on that, but how much does it cost to put a movie into theaters?
I get this question, you know, 10 times a week, and my answer, while, you know, glib, is unfortunately the only answer I can give, and that is, how long is a piece of string? You know, how much, you know, there are certain basics. You know, you need to have materials. You need to have a poster. Some films, small films, open without a trailer. Or in some cases now, you can, you know, a filmmaker can cut their own trailer, and it can be put on a QuickTime file, and it can go into some theaters. Not all theaters, but some can do that. So the cost can be dramatically reduced because you can make your own trailer. You don't need to deal with a lab. You don't need to output. You don't need any of that stuff. You can design your own poster. It may not be the most effective poster, but it will be the least expensive poster. You can get them printed. You know, maybe it won't be on the best stock. Maybe the colors won't be great. Maybe there'll be this or that missing. You don't have to have it rated. You mean, anything can be done. You can put a film into a theater for next to no money. The theater, generally speaking, is going to want some sort of guarantee that you'll do something to promote it. And this is also, this is a constant, I would say politely, dialogue between with some exhibitors, because not everybody fully understands how a film can be most effectively promoted. Maybe you don't need print ads for something. If you have a film that's going to appeal to 14-year-old girls, why put an ad in the New York Times?
But it all is based on, like, the ultimate strategy that you have, right? Because there's like a domino effect that I've found. And the domino effect is that there's efficiencies in, if you have the ability to get it, right? Some films can and some folks can't. But if you have the ability to get national media, really you've got to open up in New York. And New York is the most expensive media market in the country.
If you're going to get national media, you're going to need to open up in more than New York.
Right.
Because it's not, if, you know, you're not going to get on the Today Show or
Ellen. You can't
go
backwards, right? You can't start in Atlanta. It's not like a band. A band could start and build their base in the South, and then when they're huge, they could come to New York. That model doesn't really work for film, or does? I mean, because
it's a shame. It's hard to do that now. I've tried to do it a few years ago with a film that had its natural audience in the heartland, and what's happened now, because of what's happened to newspapers, is this is a film that dealt with that appealed to a more mature audience, which is to say an older audience that still reads newspapers. The problem is that a lot of communities no longer have local film critics, but don't even run reviews sometimes, because the only reviews they run come on some of the national syndicates. So if you don't get reviewed in the Philadelphia Inquirer or the New York Times or the LA Times or one of the Chicago papers, you're not syndicated. The review's not syndicated. So you might open up in Atlanta, and if they don't have a critic, you don't get a review. You know, if you don't get a review from the local critic in St. Louis, there's no review that they can run. So suddenly you're opening up in a market that has a natural audience for the film, the natural audience that reads the newspaper, but there's no review.
So we did The Way together. And The Way, would you have wanted to open The Way in without opening it first in New York? Like, would it have made more sense? I mean, it wouldn't have, because we wouldn't have had the national kind of thrust that Richard's talking about. But from a box office standpoint, would it have been better if New York was not the opening weekend?
Well, I mean, I think we came as close to that as you can. I think Richard's right. And again, I'm a novice in this, or an observer more than anything, is that you've got to collect a lot of national media, and you do that by opening in New York. You earn a lot of suspicion if you don't open in New York, because people think you're hiding something. There's such a sort of chauvinism of the media in New York. They think that if for some reason you open it outside New York, you're trying to keep it, you're hiding the ball from the national media and critics. Yeah, I mean, it costs a lot to open in New York. And I think what we did, I mean, we opened at 42nd Street. Well, I mean, we opened a little bit, but we really realized that The Way was going to play better outside of New York. I mean, it turned out that a lot of assumptions we made on The Way weren't right, and a lot of things we had to do on The Way. I mean, we could devote like a six-hour panel to what we learned and what we were forced to do and how it hurt the film. Weren't
that would
right.
Be the self-immolation panel.
It would culminate with Richard lighting himself on fire and being relieved. It was a massive learning experience for me. It was just a pain in the ass for you, I know. But just to ask a question on what you were saying, if you weren't going to open in New York, if you had a film that was going to play much better in the heartland, could you show the film to like the AP critic or to the people who are syndicated, who are based in New York, couldn't you? And with the understanding that they would run their review in the St. Louis paper, but it wouldn't have to run in New York because the film wasn't opening in New York.
I've never seen that happen, and the person who was in this room a minute ago who might have been able to answer it. Oh, there's Cynthia. I didn't see. What do you think, Cynthia? We need to get you a mic. Okay, right behind you.
Did you hear my question, Cynthia?
Did you hear the question? Cynthia did the PR on The Way, so this is a perfect question for her.
So the question is
If you weren't going to open a film in New York, if you knew a film wasn't going to play in New York and you wanted to open it in the heartland, could you screen it for critics that are syndicated out of New York to run in those local papers, even though the film isn't going to get reviews in New York?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know if it would just be the AP, I would think, right? It would be the AP.
Yeah. Because
The New York Times, they're not going to pick, I mean, that doesn't happen until it actually runs in the paper. So the only one would be the AP. So
I mean,
when
I guess
you get AP to run a review when the movie's open, I don't know why you wouldn't be able to do that.
AP isn't picked up universally.
Pretty widely.
But Roger, you'd screen it for Roger. I mean, if you screened it for people who were syndicated.
Also, I mean, but again, I think it has to run in their market.
Yeah.
Roger, the guy in Orlando.
No, Roger Ebert.
No, that's Roger.
But yeah, Roger Moore. Oh, yeah, the guy in Orlando who gets syndicated.
Roger Ebert's reviews do not run until the movie opens in Chicago.
Yeah.
Until it opens. So he wouldn't write a review, even if it wasn't opening in Chicago, that would play in the cities who usually run his reviews?
Doesn't run until it...
So that's why the web... I mean, this is why I love digital. Because, I mean, this is where my head always goes to say, well, then what happens? And the syndication issue is important for print. I mean, we're really talking about...
For
specific films that are more print-based. And that's why I love hearing these conversations, because then I get obsessed to say, well, then how do we shift things so that this problem can start to go away? I mean, certainly, you know, if a film opens, you know, what we learned, I think, is, and the stigma is still very true, that kind of downtown, uptown, is that I found, and I don't know if you agreed, but if we're at the Angelica kind of downtown or the Sunshine, we're pulling in much more of a digital audience than if we're in the, you know, the Lincoln Plaza or something uptown. They're still very print, you know, New York Times based, and you could have the same film and have two very different demographics. And so what I get interested is, like, I can't fix the Lincoln Plaza problem right now digitally, because that's a region and you only have a pool of people that are willing to travel in, and it's not a long way that they're willing to go because they can see it a couple of months digitally, so they don't need to make it across town even. So I look at it and say, well, digital can solve kind of the issue with the downtown theaters. And how do you shift that, you know? And I get very excited when I look at these challenges because then maybe there's digital solutions.
Well, there's another answer to the question about can you open regionally before you open nationally. And it does depend on the nature of the film. If there's a very specific audience that you can define and you can determine an approach to them and a way to access them and a cost effectively, it's possible. I have a company called Area 23A that's it's event film based, and we had a film a year or two ago called The Mighty Uke. It's a documentary about the ukulele, which is interesting to this many people. However, every one of those people knew about the film because they're so focused and they're so interested. And it didn't cost us a penny. We opened that film all the way down the West Coast, didn't spend a penny in advertising. It was all online. It was all online social media without any paid advertising. And one of the things that we did was we brought in a ukulele virtuoso who had a mailing list, and we coordinated the release of the film with his tour so that if he was going to be in San Francisco performing on Tuesday, we brought the movie in on either Monday or Wednesday. And he went out to his mailing list and said, hey, this movie is going to show at such and such a theater at 7 o'clock, and I'll be there afterwards, bring a ukulele, we'll have a little jam afterwards for 20 minutes. So it worked as both a promotion for the film and a promotion for his show, and he was already on the way, so there were no incremental costs.
So these are the details. I mean, I don't know how many people pick up some of the little details that I had to kind of learn over time and then actually see the data, because what you just said, you basically said Monday and Tuesday, and then you kind of added Wednesday. Most people, when they hear kind of event programming, they're thinking that that's Friday night, Saturday night, or Sunday, so that they're getting the largest audience for their event as well, but they're actually booking the days where those theaters are very quiet. And what I mean about the data, you know, I'm shocked, and when we were having lunch, I'm saying when I look at the Rentrak per city, per market, when a lot of these films that have stars are in 50 screens, their per screen average, which again is way, you can't take it too seriously, but sometimes it's, you know, $290, which if it doesn't take a genius to kind of do the math, and that means that in some theaters on Tuesday, there's five people in that theater for that film. And these are not films that nobody's ever heard of. These are films that have stars. So on those nights, they're crickets. I mean,
which is why, you know, the exhibitors are delighted when you can bring some kind of an event to the theater on a Monday or Tuesday, because otherwise they're fairly empty.
And that's leading to kind of this whole wave of event. Are you, you know, I'm hearing a lot of, you know, filmmakers are saying that are built up their Twitter followings or they have brands because of digital brands. They're saying, hey, you know, I'm now getting emails all the time saying, will you tweet out my little movie? They're actually now becoming presenters and looking to use their brand equity to help younger filmmakers or films that are untapped find that audience through their own introduction into distribution as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a revolution going on. There's a crowdsourcing revolution going on to build communities around films, to raise money for films, but also I've been hearing a lot about TUG, which is, you know, a crowdsourcing model for basically filling up these theaters through which crickets are playing, you know, during the week. One of the revelations for me in becoming a distributor was to see how and the numbers were always there, but I never focused on them, to see how shockingly low the midweek numbers are in so many theaters. I mean, literally, yeah. You're right. There'll be like five people screening a film in an entire theater for a night, and that is a respectable performance for a holdover film. It's like,
yeah. Again, the data, it just, you learn so much by really looking at the details. But going back to that event model, there's a lot of talk also about digital distribution and things going digital. And, you know, one thing that's also unclear to me is, in the long run, is digital actually cheaper than prints? I mean,
not for independents. This is not the platform for me to rail against that, but it's it's very, very complicated for small films, small companies, and independent producers, because the model works for studios, because that's the way the system is set up. It does not work for independents. I mean, you know...
Explain why I'm not...
Briefly, what we would do is we would have... I make 10 prints. From those 10 prints, I can play the entire country. I will move the print from theater to theater to theater. Over time, the quality of the image will deteriorate. It might happen the first night when the projectionist doesn't focus in the, not the, when he doesn't focus on what he's doing, not the frame, and there's an emulsion scratch and I lose a print that way. Usually you can argue and get that paid for, but let's say you can get, you know, 4 months, 3 or 4 months out of one print to go from market to market.
Or you get them from international too. I mean, when we did Senna and Exit, and didn't we use, like, we saved a lot of money because we used the prints that came from the UK, right?
Is anyone from the MPAA here?
Sorry.
There were a couple of curses in that foreign print that we didn't get out for the U.S. But basically, in essence, you move the print from theater to theater to theater, and you can amortize the $1,000 or $1,200 cost of that print over time and over venues, and it starts to become a good investment. With digital, when you're dealing with the large circuits, you're dealing with what they... It's Orwellian, the virtual print fee. You're paying every time you go into a theater, you're paying $800 or $850 for access to that theater. If you play on one side of 42nd Street for 2 weeks and you're done there and you move to the other side of 42nd Street, you can't just walk a print across. You might be able to walk the drive across, but to actually get it onto the projector, it's another $800.
Can't they? I mean, as they amortize the cost of those machines...
There is a sunset and within a year or two, but you have to live that long. And then even then, there are issues about conform. You know, taking your master and conforming it to the system. There are expenses involved with that.
But it's
there are a lot of theaters that are doing Blu-ray. A lot of the mom-and-pop theaters are doing Blu-ray. I truly have not heard one complaint from any exhibitor that they get complaints from patrons about the quality of the image.
How many seats? So to have a throw for a Blu-ray, we're talking 200? You could have 200, 300 seats?
You know, I don't know, but I've never had an issue ever with it. No one's ever said, I mean, maybe I'm not getting, no one at the Ziegfeld with 1,200 seats has ever said, can we throw up a Blu-ray on screen?
Well, I wonder, I mean, how much, but maybe it doesn't have less information than...
I don't know. It may be a function of the projector more than, you know, if you can put it through the right projector. But, Blu-ray could be a savior for us. We, you know, we save the amount of money we save on shipping, the amount of money we save on creating the actual disc is a great thing, and a lot of the smaller theaters are doing that.
So the other thing that comes up all the time and is all of these different, you know, approaches that are being experimented with, ultra VOD, where, you know, there's a window of a film coming out prior on either VOD or now iTunes, and then going out to the theater, or day and date hybrid, where you're in the theater the same date that you're in the you're on VOD and digital, and there's a lot of complexities to those models as well, because to get into the theaters, it's not as easy if you are also
showing up. You write off the three big chains and a lot of the smaller companies that won't play a film in the theater when it's on VOD. It's a model that I understand the law. It's a huge pain in the neck for someone who's a theatrical distributor, because it really limits your options. There simply aren't that many theaters where you can do that.
But the pain in the neck is coming from the exhibitors.
Yeah, no, that's why it's a pain in the neck, because you don't have the options. You don't have the exhibition options for
it. Do you want to talk about how Margin Call was able to surmount
that?
Sure,
they rented theaters at a great cost. It's called four-walling. They rented a bunch of theaters because there was – this is also sort of a curious semantic distinction here, because they – some of the circuits will allow you to be day and date VOD, to have VOD the same day as you're in theatrical, if you rent the theater for the week. It guarantees them a minimum of revenue. I think the logic is confusing and a little self-defeating, because no consumer understands what the deal is behind the scenes. So you just, you know, you look up on the screen and you say, hey, this movie is playing at, you know, at AMC 42nd Street, and then you go on TV and you see, wow, it's available on VOD, so I guess, you know, it's available in the theater and it's available on television. You don't know that there's a special deal made to provide access to that theater. So I'm not sure I'm not sure what that imaginary line is about, other than protecting their revenue base. And I think that based on, if you want to base it on margin call, their revenue, they probably got hurt by four-walling the theater because the film did so much business initially that my guess is the theaters might have made more money had they had traditional deal structure.
You're sounding like Tom Bernard now.
Oh, shoot me.
I know.
There was a lot of talk, and I consider it a film, but Louis C.K., you know, shot his own comedy special, the type of show that you would see on comedy, you know, the Comedy Channel, but paid for it 100% himself, and then distributed it digitally, direct, and immediately everybody started thinking, is, you know, should we be doing this? And that's another, you know, another option. And not everybody has the tonality or the audience of a Louis C.K. When you look at the output, the quality, it's basically a comedy film. It's a performance film. Do you guys feel like some of the things that we might be doing in the next 18 months together would have that type of distribution for films? Do you guys get filmmakers asking you about
it? It's the rare person, certainly the rare filmmaker, that has such a committed, addressable, identifiable audience where you know you can say, this is what I'm going to do, and 1,000 of them or 100,000 will show up. There are opportunities like that every now and again. I think that to some degree the World Wrestling, whatever they call themselves, I can't remember if it used to be...
World Wrestling Entertainment?
And yeah, they have a committed audience, and I think they can do stuff like that. If you have a brand that's so well established, I think you can do stuff like that, but it's, you know, like this. That's sort of a magnification of the ukulele story, yeah. I was talking about.
I mean, this is the Wild West of the days of figuring out the way to optimally maximize your brand. If you know, there's so many things coming online that you can, the ways that you can monetize. There are all these new subscription services that are going to come on to compete with Netflix. It's going to be a crazy time. And like what Louis did is to go directly to his audience and did it in a way that was really promotable. You know, he made the fact that he did, you know, non-protected copying was a marketing decision more than as much as anything. You know, it was a political decision, but it was a marketing decision as well. You know, Kevin Smith has 2 million followers. Who, you know, I don't think it's that big a leap to think that he is going to find a way to go directly to his fans to have them consume and sort of disintermediate, you know.
The other thing that I see coming up is when Kickstarter started to be talked about, and it was the Sundance stuff, it was always talked about as kind of helping funding the creation of the film, the marketing of the film. But now, because of also digital distribution, I'm seeing a lot of filmmakers looking at experimenting and modeling with Kickstarter to actually get the film into theaters, to get the film to people directly, and taking it as a distribution driver, not as a funding to make my project that I desperately love. And that's also an interesting...
Yeah, I mean, you made a point that I thought was brilliant before, about a couple months ago, and it sort of put a light bulb on in my head, is that Kickstarter isn't really so much about raising money, it's about raising awareness and creating
building
a community.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we learned, we just did an experiment, and when we went into it, I'll be honest with you, I wasn't completely on board, but it was incredible. We with Cynthia Schwartz, we have a film called Boy, which played at Sundance a couple of years ago. It's a beautiful film, very quirky, and the filmmakers wanted to use Kickstarter to raise money to expand the film nationally. And when I heard about the idea, I was very nervous about it because of a lot of reasons that would take too much time to explain. But we did it, and one of the things that was, for me, fascinating was there was now probably 1,900 people, which, again, in the grand scheme might not be massive, but 1,900 people had given $20, $10, or whatever, and they were so vested in our theatrical success that we had, for the first time in the U.S., this incredibly very, very loyal community to help us be successful. And when we looked at the opening weekend in New York, which did very, very well, with not a lot of budget being spent for marketing, the Kickstarter, forget the Kickstarter money, because that was completely different. But the Kickstarter community that came from raising the money definitely had an impact on the box office success of that film and will continue to. And for me, that was an eye-opener because I knew that the community was strong, but I didn't know that it could be used as a way to aggregate community. Because when you think about it, you know, not everybody goes to Facebook and becomes part of that. There's people do lots of different things.
You know, you mentioned Tug before, and I for something I hadn't heard of, and I blame myself for this, until a month ago, I've heard nothing but Tug for the last month or so. And it's a fascinating opportunity, but it's not something that's going to work in a vacuum. It's the kind of thing that is ideal for someone like Louis C.K. or someone like Kevin Smith, someone who has an established audience who can encourage them to say, well, if, you know, we'll, you know, demand it, basically. Tell, you know, say you want to bring it to this town, you get enough people, we'll bring it there.
I'm not, you know, I'm going to say something about demand it because you just used the word, and I'm not advising them or what have you, but there's so many things that are out there that you get, especially with digital. There's a lot of snake oil salesmen of I can do this and I can do that, and that's one of the problems of being in digital marketing is that everybody's got some sort of thing, and because you can't see always digital, you know, you can't always see it, you have to go with the leap of faith. The one thing, though, that I would spend money on, and again, I'm not doing this because of any vested interest, but the one thing that I have seen success on is actually demand it. And it's because demand it, the data shows you the intent to purchase, not just the database being targeted because they liked, you know, a certain band or because they live in, you know, in Minneapolis. It's because you know your conversion rate to an intent to purchase. And for me, that is critical to be able to know, is this working? You know, because the data can be so wrong. I had an argument with a guy once who asked me, should he spend, and I don't remember the number, let's say for sake of argument, it's $15,000 to do some, you know, again, this hocus pocus stuff of getting a trailer, but it wasn't really the trailer, but it was a version of it on the homepage of YouTube, and he was guaranteed something like 15 million views. And I said, don't do it. And he said, you got to be, why would I not do this? And I said, because the 15 million views are absolutely tonnage views. They're cheap. They're not going to convert. So he did it, and he called me, and he was very, you know, excited. He says, I was promised 15, I got 25. And I said, okay, can you do me a favor? Give me the access to the data. And YouTube, again, all of these places have, they'll give you the data. They're not, their whole business is giving out data. So I looked at the data, and it was exactly what I thought. The views, and it was literally 80% of the views were for a demo that was less than 21 years old, and the movie was targeting 52-year-olds. And so if you looked at it from, oh, I'm successful because 25 million people looked at my trailer, that anybody could buy. And that's why I always get upset in both ways of somebody saying, well, that Facebook page of that movie has, you know, 50,000 people, or that has 1 million people. Why does my movie only have 800? And there's two reasons. Because as a digital marketer, you're supposed to get these numbers that publicly everybody could say up. But the reality is two things. One is you can buy any number you want. So a lot of these movies do have marketing that's being put in, and you could buy it. So if you buy it, that's how you get it. Well, you should be doing this without buying it, okay? But the truth is that when you talk about community, community doesn't happen digitally. Community is either organic or it's something that happens because all of the marketing or all of the things are working. It can't just be digital. And that's why, again, you know, being on the panel with the two of these guys and then with Cynthia in the back and Nancy was here, is that for me, the reason why these movies work is because there isn't a digital department. There's nobody saying, well, we have a digital guy, and we've hired, you know, these low-level agencies, and they kind of will come in on a special call once every 3 weeks. It's that digital is not its own thing. It's the amplification of everything that's happening. And if you just play the numbers, the metrics, without understanding the context, it could be very, very tricky. And you can do, I see, we work very closely with Ed Burns. Ed Burns has 35,000 people on Twitter, I think, and his fans. Other actors have 500,000, right? But Eddie Burns' 35,000 has a stronger impact than somebody else's 800,000, because those 35,000 are so loyal because of the way that he speaks to them and gets them involved is that they will do anything to make his movie successful for him. And people just don't get, they look at the number, they're like, 35,000, I want to give $10,000 to, you know, Kourtney Kardashian, and she's going to do it. Yeah, but there's no loyalty there.
Can I ask you a question? Because I've said this about Kevin Smith, that, yeah, he has 2 million followers and other people have 10 million followers, but his 2 million followers, the first thing they think of when they wake up in the morning is him. frighteningly. And what you said about Eddie is similar. Is there a way to sort of analyze the stickiness of followers,
you know,
the loyalty?
But I mean, I actually think that there is a challenge with the Kevin Smith model, is that one of the things that also happens is that these groups can be so insular that they actually, again, the raw numbers can be very tricky. They actually don't influence anybody else other than each other. So the volume and the passion is very high, but they're not reaching me. If Kevin Smith has a, I don't subscribe to Kevin Smith's Twitter because the way he does it, it's so fanboyish, and it's good. So it's not a criticism, but it's 25,000 tweets, and it's over and over and over again. So I can't deal with that, right? So I don't follow him. So let's say he does a movie that I would really love. His million is or 20, whatever the million is, they're never going to reach me. And that's why, again, Senna and Exit, everybody, you know, if we had marketed Exit to graffiti fans or to street art fans, we would have died after the, I mean, that's a limited amount of audience.
One night.
If we would have marketed Senna to motorsports fans only, we would have died. My challenge with the Kevin Smith model is that if that's a limited, even though it's a big number, he's not going to get the benefit of reaching out to other people.
Hmm. So the question of that number of people who are that loyal and that responsive, you don't need, depending upon what his intent is, the question is how is it growing?
That's right. If you see that number growing without it being spam bots and stuff. I mean, numbers also grow because when you do certain things digitally, you get a lot of spam based on what you wrote. So I can go up 200 followers tomorrow, and it's not 200 people suddenly love me. It's I wrote something that I used a word Apple. Oh, try it. Anybody on Twitter? Use the word Apple computers in your tweet. Just use those two words. You will tomorrow wake up and you will get 15 new followers, 20 new followers. Who are these people? Why suddenly do it? They're bots to make you see that because you like Apple, they're going to give you a feed. The media companies are really, really smart. I did a thing where I looked at who is really influential in social on the media side, like which reviews. And the thing about Perez Hilton and Gawker and Mashable and these guys are really smart is they know social media so well and they know how to play the game. So one of the things that a lot of these celebrity sites do is they have 4,000 automatic bots that will spam out an article that's published to that blog, right? And each one only has 150 followers, 200 followers. So it's very small, right? Why did they get those followers? Because the bot is a pretty girl. And so they get 200, and suddenly they're getting 200 more people that see this article headline. And if the headline is salacious, because it always is, they'll click on it and the numbers will spike dramatically. And so they're really, you know, I wouldn't use that. That's just, you know, advertising. I can't use that to market a movie. But what's happening is that the analog world isn't catching up yet to the Mashables of the world. These guys, if Mashable wanted to be a movie marketer tomorrow, they would kill it because they understand how all of these things work. And that's what I want to be working with the people in the room and others is to bring that sensibility in, not that spam idea that I just said, but that knowledge, because that's how others are advancing. We should open to to questions. Yeah.
People with mics, so wait till them.
Yeah.
I'm really excited that you're working with Ed Burns, because I've been dying to ask this question about his business model and his approach. A couple years ago, I was at a film festival, and the discussion of distribution came up, and the producer for Precious was talking about how she was in this legal battle with Lionsgate and how she still hadn't gotten paid. And I just thought, I've been covering the film industry
for a long
time.
Yeah, I mean, I sold Precious, and we got paid a ton really quickly, so that's weird.
Well, yeah, I'm just going off of what she told me, or what she told the crowd. And so I've been covering music for a long time, and I've been in marketing for over 15 years, and just looking at the way musicians have been going down the DIY path for a while and moving away from major labels, I just feel like, especially for indie filmmakers, that they're going down the same path as well and going direct.
So first of all, both John and I work very closely with Eddie. I met Eddie through John. And the first thing that people have to know is that the Ed Burns model is not replicable. And that's not a way to say, well, it's not a value. It's just he has a mixture of kind of amazing elements that make him very unique. And part of that is humility in the way that he'll make his movies and market the movies. And that ego is something that stops a lot of people from doing things to make a lot of money, because to do it, you have to recalibrate. So, for example, not many filmmakers would say, I don't want my movie in theaters because it's not a profitable model for me. He's one that will do things like festivals and find value. But it's not every movie. He might make a movie where he wants the theaters because that movie really fits theaters. But what he's done is it starts with digital filmmaking and having a community. But the most important thing is that as an actor, he can go on Jimmy Fallon and create national awareness saying my movie is available on iTunes tonight. And that means a lot. He's willing to meet with fashion bloggers and go to Mashable's offices and do things that most people would never do. He gets it. He completely gets it. And that's not something that's something that he does himself. And it's really the alchemy of 16 different little things and him doing all of them that make his model work. If you did only 5 of what he does, you wouldn't be successful. But he does all 16 of them, which is really what makes him so inspiring, I think, on so many levels, because he's willing to do things a certain way.
I'm sorry. So to your point about the fact where the film industry, just like the music industry, didn't really get digital at that time and tried to fight it and didn't embrace it at the time where it could have been of advantage to them. You were talking about wanting more of the film industry to be more knowledgeable, maybe understand those 16 points. And now, granted, Ed Burns doesn't, you know, he's got a name for himself, whereas somebody in Cleveland just doing a film doesn't. What do you see as far as the future in terms of filmmakers themselves really understanding the 360?
Well, not everyone wants to understand it, right? It's like when the labels started being less valuable for the bands, it wasn't like every band became Radiohead. I mean, or every band became, you know, the best. Most of the bands didn't. So first of all, you have to want to learn the business. And it's difficult to be a business person. I mean, I'm sure people like Eddie will struggle with growth because they're like, hold on a second, I've got to shoot a movie, or I've got to get on the phone and call Apple, and then I've got to go to a meeting. And how is that?
Yeah,
it's difficult, right?
The industry itself doesn't want this development to happen because it makes them obsolete and it empowers the creators. The future is about finding your community, finding your audience. Eddie has certain things that enable him to get to that audience and to build bigger audiences, but there is no reason why that can't happen on a smaller scale with people who don't have all those tools at their disposal. What Mark is dedicated to is connecting people to audiences. And you've got, you know, whether it's the theme of your film, whether it's the people who know you, it's all about trying to market directly to the people who want to consume what you're doing.
as long as that audience is curated and it's not too siloed. That's true, John, but also what you know I fight against is people believe that it's efficient and cheap. So if you make a movie about chess, okay, well, we'll market the movie through chess clubs and we'll go and we'll do this all on chess. And then all of a sudden, if the movie is really good, if the movie is limited, and so many movies now are great because the filmmakers are savvy in digital filmmaking, you know, you can make a movie look like $10 million with a, you know, with a Canon camera. So movies are getting better. The quality of movies are getting better. And what I hate,
technical quality.
Yeah, well, sometimes the narration. I mean, but there's a lot more better movies. And if the movie about chess is boring and nobody's really going to like it, okay, go to chess clubs and try to. But the problem I have is when people say we should only go to chess clubs when that movie should be marketed to me and I don't play chess. And I think a lot of times, because of John, that comment, they take it the wrong way. They believe, okay, my community is my little world, and I'm gonna. They make their movie so much smaller if the movie is good.
Yeah, but that's true. But the idea that you start with the community that is most likely to enjoy and consume what you're doing, and if you do have the quality and the universality, you know, use that core community to start to spread you out to a bigger constituency.
Yeah, but curate it so that you have a lot of adjacent. So your friends, like a dinner party, you don't want all people that play chess to go to a dinner party for, you know, you. It's boring. But you need a person that does, like you should curate so you have people that have all of these diverse interests, because then they'll pull your community into new places, which is the key.
I think it's inarguable, but I, if I'm not mistaken, John's point is something that I talk about all the time, and it's recognizing that you can see audiences like an archery target. And if you can guarantee, or if you can at least address effectively the bullseye, then you can generate enough revenue and enough interest to justify the continued attempt at expanding that. It's a very cost-effective way of getting off the ground and then justifying an expansion. If you know you have a core, you know, like the ukulele movie, I handled a movie on the liberation of Estonia from the Soviet Union and the use of folk song to maintain a national identity. That makes the ukulele audience look like the Titanic audience. And yet, you know, 20,000 Americans identify themselves as having Estonian heritage. So you know where they all are. You start there. If the movie has what it takes to expand beyond that, then you can do it. But at least you know that your initial focus is going to justify the effort in some way.
And this is a very healthy debate.
That marketing I get. For me, it's like too often, especially with cause-related films, this kills me. When a filmmaker makes a film that I fall in love with, but I don't really care about the issue when I went into seeing the movie, I walked away caring about it, and all of a sudden 100% of the marketing effort is being trying to get into theaters the causes. And I get it, because then you sell out to groups the opening weekend and you come out strong, but then you crater and you go nowhere because nobody said to my wife, you need to see. I mean, when I saw, you know, who killed the electric car, I didn't care about electric cars. Somebody told me that's a great movie and I loved it. You know, for Richard Lorber's films, I mean, if we took the strategy, you have to care about, you know, Gerhard Richter to love the movie Gerhard Richter.
You can't ignore
that's going to be,
you know, in an industry that's so front loaded, in a business where if you don't have a good opening weekend, you don't have a second weekend. You need to do whatever you possibly can to guarantee that you have a turnout so that you have the opportunity to expand the audience. If you don't focus on the core audience initially and motivate them and create a sense of urgency so that they go immediately, then you will have
just
no
curate.
Opportunity
okay.
to expand.
So I agree with you. So what I'm saying is, like, when you do that Gerhard Richter screening at MoMA, invite 50 people that are not those people, or figure out a way to, you know, to get other people in there.
I agree, and I watched it happen when you curated those screenings for Exit Through the Gift Shop, which was a very diverse audience. And I think part of the beauty and effectiveness of that is having a gallery owner and a museum curator and a tattoo artist in the
right.
same room and enjoying the experience and looking at each other and going, wow, it's not just me.
Look at these people from
different worlds. This has a potentially broader application than I would have thought. I mean, that kind of word of mouth is invaluable, but you can't do that and neglect the core audience, because that's what you can count on. You cannot ignore your base. And I saw somebody over
there.
Yeah,
there was one in the back, too. Yeah.
Somebody has a mic, actually.
Do I have the mic? Mark, a bit ago you talked about knowing your conversion rate from intent to purchase. Did you mention some some tools or a website and I missed it? Or
did what? I hear the second part of it.
When you talked about the conversion rate from intent to purchase, did you mention some tools or website?
The tools are actually – it's not – the tools – everybody has these tools. Nobody knows how to look at the tools, and nobody's ever said to look at it. And a lot of people, by the way, don't want to look at it. So it's like not that everybody's, oh, I want to learn it. Google Analytics is a very, very powerful thing that was never made for movie marketing. It was made for people to make a lot of money through e-commerce, right? So Google Analytics has things that no film website ever will use because they don't even, so they're still on the one basic. How many hits do I have? That's the only thing they have. When I look at Google Analytics, I look at where's the traffic coming, which articles are driving more, how much are clicking on the buy. So we can, through Google Analytics, put, if it's a DVD or if we're going to VOD, I could put a cost of $12 against a click. And then I can say, over time, I could do the math, not every click is going to convert to purchase, but I can tell you roughly how much of the revenue for the Waze digital footprint came from the website based on codes that I put in and a price per a click. Anybody can do this. I didn't pay for it. I didn't buy it. Just nobody would ever do that because they don't even want to update the website to even put the link to iTunes. Half of these websites for digital, they've never been updated because nobody wants to spend the time to do it. They're still talking about theatrical. So 90% of the data that I get are open to everybody. There's not. It's just looked at different. I know for Eddie Burns that for iTunes sales, what drove the most sales were fashion bloggers. And the way that we got fashion bloggers, we put them in an event that they wrote the experience. They weren't critics. But Elle Magazine, Elle.com, had more of an impact on him making money from iTunes than the movie website review, because I look at the data.
We have no time, but somebody in the back has been
waiting. We can continue it in the hallway or something. Yeah.
Yeah, I can wait till the hallway.
Okay, you can wait till the hallway.
Got a hallway question.
Who can't wait till the hallway?
Wrap it up? Okay. Wrap it up.
Sorry.